Shuttle 19 Uniform, thank you. Descend flight level 110.
0, Shuttle 19 Uniform.
Surrounding 28 Romeo Yankee, we're climbing flight level 70 on the Otago departure.
Emirates 6 Oscar Bay, continue right turn on navigation now to Dulles.
Blue Messenger for Victor Hotel, turn right heading 325.
Well, hello and welcome to this very first podcast from Flight Deck Wingman. The podcast is called For Flying Out Loud. My name is Andrew. I'm the host of the show, and I'm really looking forward to welcoming you on this journey of aviation, a source of inspiration, hopefully, to many people listening out there, a source of real interesting listening with some of our fantastic guests who will be joining us soon. So for now, welcome to this podcast. Let's get started. So where did this passion for aviation start? Well, very early, as is quite common with a lot of pilots, but not all, actually. But I would say it probably started in the pushchair for me. My mum certainly tells me of stories that if an aircraft flew overhead, even whilst I was still very, very young, I would often look up at the sky and indeed say the word sky. Latterly, my father got his private pilot's license. He was a local GP, and I was lucky enough, of course, to go and do some flying with my dad. And that clearly inspired me even more that this was something I really wanted to do. Of course, not everybody is lucky enough to achieve their dream, and indeed, I wasn't sure if I would, especially when in the 1980s, as a young child of about 11 years old, the movie Top Gun came out. And of course, that inspired a whole generation to become fighter pilots and indeed Navy fighter pilots. But of course, that's something that I didn't really think was within my grasp, although I definitely did not give up on the dream. I might add at this stage, and I want to talk about it a bit more later, that I probably didn't recognise, actually I did already have a head start as someone from a relatively privileged background with a great family, my dad and a good job, being a man, I think certainly made things easier for me, and I'll talk more about that later. School life, though, wasn't without its challenges for me, and although I had this dream to become a pilot, I was a child in a working class area in the 1980s. My dad was the local GP. I also have a foreign surname, Neofitu. And this, of course, as can be the case with lots of young people, caused some issues for me at school. And in fact, it led to many, many years of being bullied and not a pleasant experience. And for anybody out there listening to this who is maybe being bullied or has been bullied, you're not alone. What it did inspire me to do, though, was to stay even more motivated at achieving my dream. So essentially, I hid myself away and invested everything that I had into achieving my dream. So from joining the air cadets, from building model aircraft, from just trying to speak to pilots at the local flying club where my dad did his flying. So I threw myself into it, and everything that I did was around aircraft. I was really lucky, actually, at 16 years old to be awarded a Royal Air Force Flying Scholarship. And at that stage in 1992, that meant 30 hours of flying. And to give you some context behind that, to get 40 hours gave you your private pilot's license. So at 16 years old, around about a week before I started my, before my 17th birthday rather, I started my flying training. And very soon after turning 17, I had my private pilot's license, which was, of course, absolutely amazing. I hadn't even learned how to drive a car, and there I was still in between years in the sixth form and having gained my private pilot's license, taking friends flying. And it was a really, really exciting time. Although it was at this point that I realised that bullies and jealousy didn't necessarily come from other children. And in fact, at the time, the boss of my local air cadets, where I was a member and who which I'd been awarded this flying scholarship, couldn't even bring himself to award me my flying scholarship wings in person at the rest of in front of the rest of the air cadets, and posted them to my home address, which was a real insight as a young person. I recognised for the first time that people of all ages can act in ways that you really would hope they wouldn't. The same is true with one or two of the teachers at the school. And I might add the vast majority of teachers at my secondary school were genuinely wonderful, wonderful teachers. But one or two, and this is not a point of jealousy, but certainly a point of not necessarily encouraging me or inspiring me or helping me achieve my dream. And I remember being told by one of the teachers that not everybody achieved their dreams and I should probably be a little bit more realistic. But again, that inspired me to keep moving. Around the same time, a new boss at the Air Cadet Squadron arrived, a female boss, and she was fantastic. And in fact, I owe an awful lot to that lady, and I wish I could remember her name because she really did help inspire me and develop my confidence. So there I was, young holder of a PPL, hoping still to achieve my dreams. But unfortunately, down to the school bullying, I didn't do particularly well at school, having been a very successful student. Of course, it wasn't popular to be successful, so that led to me perhaps not working as hard. However, that didn't stop me getting to university, albeit by the skin of my teeth, having not achieved particularly good grades and certainly not good enough to start on the course without making some phone calls and convincing them that they should give me a chance. But I was really successful in getting this place at university to study aeronautical engineering. And the reason I chose that degree was I had heady ambitions to become a test pilot. You know, seeing people flying all these different types of aircraft, particularly fighter aircraft, I thought, well, you know, this is going to help me. And it probably would have done if my career had taken a different path and if I'd have been good enough to become a test pilot. The degree wasn't exactly what I expected. It entailed an awful lot of maths, something I wasn't particularly natural at, but I did well enough to achieve a 2-1 degree at university. One of the things I did do at university was join the University Air Squadron, which is a military organisation that enables people to learn how to fly whilst at university. And of course, already having my private pilot's licence and having aspirations to become a fighter pilot, this was the perfect place for me to go and indulge in that. Had a fantastic time in general terms on the University Air Squadron, made some great friends, some of which I'm still friends with to this day. And in fact, you might even hear from one or two of them on later podcasts. But one of the downsides, again, it's a sort of an eye-opening, these stages you go through in life, was it was my first sort of witnessing of a clique and led by one of the older instructors. And I wasn't part of that clique and I've never really liked them, to be honest with you. Ultimately, what happened right at the end of my time at university, right at the end of my time in the University Air Squadron, I was out flying in an aircraft called a Bulldog, a small single-engine piston aircraft, and I was doing my final navigation test. And for those of you not familiar with this type of thing, this sort of test would have perhaps led to me being more successful on my path to joining at that stage. I was hopeful to join the Royal Air Force as a fast jet pilot. The instructor, however, didn't clearly have this confidence in me. And in fact, I got hopelessly lost on my low-level navigation exercise. And the same instructor that led this clique that I wasn't a part of took control of the aircraft, turned to me, calmly said, but not in a soothing way, I might add, that I should give up the dream. I wasn't good enough. I was roughly 20 years old at that stage. And of course, this was all I'd ever wanted to do. And to have an adult say that to me could, again, have had a terrible impact on me. And I would call on all adults in positions of responsibility and privilege, you know, to this particular instructor had been a former fast jet pilot, to just think really, really carefully about what you say to people. Certainly now, I try and act as a source of genuine inspiration to people, and I would never, ever tell somebody to give up their dream, but certainly to work hard toward achieving it. So I left university at that stage, clearly a little bit dejected, but not entirely dissuaded from pursuing my dream. I applied to the Royal Air Force directly, and I was unsuccessful. So things really weren't looking very good at this stage. I was back with my parents. I needed to find some work to pay off some debts, and the only work that I could find quickly was in a local factory, wiring up boilers. And a lot of the people that worked at the factory, with my dad being the local GP, thought I shouldn't have actually been there. I was somehow taking a job away from someone else that should have that job. And actually, again, another learning point, discrimination can actually come from anywhere. However, I work really, really hard to build relationships with the guys I work with winding up these boilers. And I broke down those barriers. And I learnt an awful lot about people along the way. And looking back on it now, as with all of the topics I'm going to talk about here, that led to a whole bunch of real key benefits that have helped me later on in life, learning about people from all walks of life, how people interact, how people view things, how to build bridges, work with people that might not be the same ilk as you are, but it's really key. And I believe that everyone should get involved in other areas of work before they perhaps embark fully on a new career. It really does teach you a lot of things. Anyway, so having been unsuccessful with the Royal Air Force, which is, I might add, something that my RAF friends still banter me with to this day, I applied then to the Royal Navy. At that stage, I didn't even know, believe it or not, that the Royal Navy flew fast jets. I thought it was mainly helicopters, and wanting to be a fighter pilot, of course, that's why I'd applied to the Air Force first. I was pleasantly surprised, of course, to see that the Royal Navy, in fact, did fly fast jets in the form of the Sea Harrier. But of course, it being an incredibly small niche group of pilots, I really thought that's probably not going to happen, but I'm still going to work very hard at trying to achieve it. So I applied to the Royal Navy, went through what they call the Admiralty Interview Board, and I was successful in being selected as a Royal Naval Officer. That was back in around 96, 97 time, and well, it's an awful long time ago now thinking about it. Officer training in the Royal Navy lasts just over a year, and it's a grueling time, but it's one which teaches you huge benefits that you can bring to general life. For the first 6 weeks, we didn't even leave Britannia Royal Naval College in Dartmouth, save for a period of time on Dartmoor in what they called the practical leadership exercise, PLX. And anyone that's been through that process will know it's not a particularly pleasant process. However, the friends that I made during my time during officer training, the things that I learned from timekeeping, being on time for everything, upkeep of morale, even in adversity, the absolute belief in teamwork, and that actually, although we were all there having leadership training, that all leaders are not natural. And of course, you'd expect that to be the case. But it amazes me actually to this day that leadership, true leadership, is often lacking in corporate companies. And we don't, of course, call people leaders necessarily in the corporate world. They're mainly referred to as management, senior management, etc. But some do get to the top through natural ability to lead, but many don't. And I believe that this causes structural breakdown within companies. I certainly believe that a leader is only fulfilling a role within a team, and they're no better than any other member of that team. And they're simply there to fulfill that role, which is to lead the team to a successful outcome. I think that management and organisational structures should look far more carefully at leadership and really think, are we putting the right person in the job? Anyway, I digress on leadership, but it's my time at Dartmouth taught me a huge amount, and I'm very, very grateful for that time. Joined the Royal Navy as a pilot. I then went through my elementary flying training. There are several stages of flying training for any military pilot, and they build on each other. So starting at the very basic level, it was called elementary flying training. And this was in a small aircraft called the Firefly. They're still flying. A lot of flying training schools are using them now to deliver what they call upset recovery training for commercial pilots before they start their commercial flying with an airline. That was a really great time, really great fun flying. I was around about 23 years old and flying in formation, doing aerobatics. And again, I met some inspirational people along the way, one of which sadly is no longer with us. He was my first instructor, and I'd met him many, many years ago at my dad's private flying club. And I'd forgotten because I was only about 7 or 8 years old. But my dad certainly remembered this gentleman. He was called Alan Wade. And Alan, without a doubt, was the most gifted pilot I've ever met. He was an inspirational character and a superb pilot. Alan, in fact, flew competition aerobatics. He latterly went on to become a warbird pilot. And tragically, we lost Alan last year following a period of illness. But an inspirational character, certainly the best pilot I've ever flown with. At the end of this elementary flying training, you are then selected in the Royal Navy. And the same is true for the Air Force, but in the Royal Navy, the choices are you going to become a helicopter pilot or are you going to become a fast jet pilot? I was extremely pleased to hear that I'd been selected for fast jet training. And at this stage, we moved from the elementary flying training stage to what they call the basic fast jet training stage. And that was at that stage up in Yorkshire at RAF Linton-on-Ouse, which is now closed, sadly. From that first period of learning to fly, essentially what was a fast jet-esque aircraft was quite honestly one of the biggest leaps in flying training of my life. For the first time, I was sat in a tandem aircraft rather than sitting side by side. So I was in the front of the aircraft wearing an oxygen mask, kitted up feeling like I was flying a fast jet. The Tucano aircraft, of course, for those of you that know what they are, was not a fast jet. It was a turboprop aircraft, but still capable of flying pretty fast speeds, 240 knots at low level, and a really, really fun time. Those days flying the Tucano were some of the best days of my life. I was one of only a handful, and I mean three or four Royal Navy pilots amongst a myriad of Royal Air Force pilots. So having been unsuccessful with my Royal Air Force selection, I'm now flying with the same guys that I would have gone through my officer selection for the Royal Air Force with, and there were over 100 of them to the maybe four Royal Navy pilots. But of course, many, many of these pilots from the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy have become lifelong friends, and I'm extremely grateful to have them. From the Tucano, we move on to the Hawk training, and that happens over at RAF Valley in Anglesey. And this time I am flying a fast jet, and even if you're not a pilot, I'm sure that everybody has heard of the Royal Air Force aerobatic team, the Red Arrows, and they fly an aircraft called the Hawk, and that's the aircraft I then went to start my advanced flying training on. This really was, I thought, now, you know, I'm really starting to do everything that I dreamt of. Fast jet training, well, all military training, but obviously I can only speak from the fast jet point of view, but it was incredibly demanding flying. I honestly wasn't sure what stages that I would get through that training. It seems almost insurmountable that you are going to be able to navigate a fighter jet 250 feet above the ground at 7 miles per minute whilst having to avoid other aircraft that are coming to attack you, and doing all of this to hit a target within 5 seconds with nothing but a map and a stopwatch. Yet the training in the military, in the British military, certainly is second to none. And of course, most people achieve that. Some along the way sadly didn't, and we called it being chopped. And, you know, that was a very, very difficult thing for people to accept. And in fact, all of us at some point were at risk of being chopped. Very few people went through flying training without ever failing anything. And every single flight, every single sortie we flew under training was assessed. And I will fully admit, even though I certainly didn't at the time, that I was not very good at receiving critique at the beginning of this process. Being a young guy, full of testosterone, now thinking I was perhaps the next best thing, I didn't want to accept on some occasions that I hadn't perhaps performed as well as I should have done. Of course, the importance of critique is vital, not just from a safety point of view in flying fast jets and a capability point of view for providing support for the military, but in life generally. And I quickly learned that if I didn't accept this critique, then it was likely that the instructors would get so annoyed with me that I would be chopped. So I started to develop in accepting critique. And in fact, as life has gone on, although occasionally I have to check myself, it's something I've got much better at. And I think everybody could learn from listening to somebody if they've got something to say that perhaps you could do something differently. Just stop and think, could I do it differently? Could I do it better? Because 9 times out of 10, you probably could if you were being honest. Anyway, we finished the advanced flying training as I say, some of the best flying I've ever done. My first experience of doing real air combat, dropping bombs, firing a gun from an aircraft, some of the best flying I ever did. But it's still not over. At the end of that stage, as a Royal Navy pilot, with the only option being to go and fly a single seat fast jet Sea Harrier, it wasn't over. And in fact, one or two people weren't quite to the standard to go and do that. And they were fantastic pilots, but not quite at the stage where they would assess to be suitable to go and start the Sea Harrier training course. But some of them were lucky enough to go essentially then and cross over or spend some time with the Royal Air Force and fly other fast jets with the Royal Air Force and then come back to the Harrier. I, of course, was absolutely ecstatic to hear that I had been successful and I was now moving on to the Sea Harrier operational conversion unit at Royal Naval Air Station in Yeovilton. So most people, again, even if you're not an aviation fanatic or geek, and I'm probably consider myself in both of those camps, will have heard of the Harrier. Of course, it was made infamous, the Sea Harrier in particular, in the Falklands conflict, although it was joined, of course, in that conflict by Royal Air Force Harriers as well. But an iconic aircraft and an incredibly demanding aircraft to fly, and it became very apparent to me very early on in the Sea Harrier conversion that there was a good reason why the standards had been so high in sending people to fly this aircraft. The very first flight you do is only preceded by a couple of simulator flights and then two flights in a two-seat training Harrier. After those two flights in a two-seat training Harrier, it is time for your first ever solo Harrier flights. Now, of course, I'm a relatively experienced pilot by this point with several hundred hours, and I've been flying fast jets for a couple of hundred hours. But to step into a Harrier aircraft, which is an operational aircraft, an aeroplane you've never sat in before because it's a single seat now, and to taxi out to the runway was incredibly nerve-wracking, incredibly exciting, and without doubt the biggest highlight of my flying career to date. The acceleration of a Sea Harrier with a relatively light fuel load, no weapons load, was something to behold. Approximately from 0 to over 100 miles per hour in approximately 4 seconds. And it's very, very hard. Even the highest performing cars, with the exception of Formula One cars, will not accelerate like that. I accelerated, took off, and we'd been told to climb into what they called the block, so an operating band of altitude where we could go and just do some general handling before returning to the circuit to land. And as I took off, I put the gear up and retracted the flaps and then pull the aircraft up into a very high nose attitude. And I look back and I still don't know what this mirror is particularly for. Joking aside, I do. But there was a mirror in the front of the Harrier, just in front of your head. And I looked in this mirror and I looked, and in the reflection of that mirror were the wings of the Harrier, completely engulfed in vapour from the air vapour condensing over the wing. And I thought, this is it. This is, am I really, really doing this? An unbelievable experience, and I wish I could relive that one flight. The rest of the training was, at that stage, involved what they called the VSTOL, the vertical short takeoff and landing flying environment of the Harrier, because, of course, it was at that stage the only military aircraft fighter jet that could hover. So we spent a lot of time learning how to hover the aircraft, transition to and from hovering flight. We'd, in fact, done a small amount of hovering before joining the Harrier, a five-hour course flying helicopters, but it really was something very different flying this regime in a fast jet, 1 minute doing 400 knots and the next minute slowing down and stopping in mid-flight to hover and then vertically land. Part of this training was conducted at Royal Air Force Wittering, which was an RAF Harrier base at that stage. And we embarked on a detachment to IF Wittering, taking a two-seat Harrier with us and a couple of single-seat Sea Harriers to learn all of this VSTOL regime, flying off short taxiways. In fact, one of the sorties involved going and landing on a concrete pad in a wooded clearing known as Vigo Pad. But it was at this stage that the reality of the danger, really, of what we were doing was tragically manifested itself for me. Without mentioning any names, although it was in the press, my instructor and my course colleague, who is still a very close friend of mine, were flying a sortie in one of the two-seat Sea Harriers, a T8, Harrier T8. And I'd said goodbye to them, outbriefed them 5 minutes before what happened next. I'd known the instructor for over 5 years, and I'd known the student for, at that stage, about 10 years. We'd been at university together. 5 minutes later, the alarm known as the crash alarm sounded at RAF Wittering. I immediately picked up the telephone, knowing that our aircraft had just gone out to fly, called the air traffic control tower, and they confirmed my worst fears, which was that our Harrier T Mark 8 had crashed. A very challenging time. I think even now, clearly, my voice you can hear was an extremely upsetting incident. I immediately mustered the assistance of our engineering colleagues, fantastic team. I mean, the teamwork within the Royal Navy when things go wrong was exceptional. And we took our vehicle, known as the Pope, and it was so called because it resembled the vehicle that the Pope drove around in on official engagements. It had a glass Perspex dome on the top of it where the instructor would sit and observe us doing our hovering. So you can imagine the vehicle I'm talking about. And I departed in the Pope vehicle with the engineering and colleagues and one of the other students, and we headed at great speed over towards the crash site. It was if anyone's ever witnessed an aircraft accident in real life, it's a very strange thing to witness, a tragic thing, of course, very strange. You see lots of familiar objects that now are in unfamiliar settings. I was the first to see the injuries that the instructor had suffered, and tragically he had lost his life, and was then the first to scale the perimeter fence to get to my friend, who had ejected over the fence and was clearly very, very shaken but alive. Then I had to make a phone call to our operations team back at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton. Quite honestly, a terrible event to witness, a terrible tragedy and loss to the Royal Navy from our instructor, a highly regarded, probably the most highly regarded ever Sea Harrier pilot in many fields, and a really, really lovely guy. But of course, I was glad that my other colleague was safe. Anyway, life goes on, and several weeks later, we returned to flying after a service inquiry into what had happened with the aircraft. And we had to return, and in fact, one of the sorties involved me returning to IF Wittering. And on the third flight of that day, we were returning from RAF Wittering back to Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, when, as I was leading my first ever lead of a pair of Sea Harriers back to Yeovilton, just north of a place called Westcott, not too far away from Heathrow, crossing an airway with the airlines operating at 90 degrees, which military traffic often did, in pretty much what they call IMC conditions, so not being able to see very much through cloud, I started to notice a bit of a vibration from the aircraft, very unusual. That lasted for about 10 seconds before there was a huge explosive noise, bang, and the whole aeroplane was violently shaking. We were at about 24,000 feet when this happened, and it took me a while, probably only seconds, but everything seems to slow down when these things happen, to recognise what was happening, and that was that I'd had an engine failure.
Did you
cry
the Everton weather? Hey, turn 1320 Zulu, code Tango, runway 27 right hand, surface wind 2010, colour code yellow, visibility 12 kilometres in rain, cloud 6 at... Apologies, broken at 600, overcast at 1500, QFE 1019, QNH 1023, fully serviceable.
Wonderful.
And what type of approach to require?
Fighters would like to recover for individual KARs once we clear the swing. Mayday, 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 winders, surge.
I spent then only approximately 2 minutes trying to restart the engine of this Sea Harrier. And for those of you not familiar, it only has one engine. And in that 2 minutes of time, I lost 15,000 feet. So I'd gone from 24,000 to 9,000 feet with no engine. And in fact, and every time I tried to restart the engine, it was effectively catching fire. And the technical term for that is a surge. Fortunately, I managed to get the engine restarted and to produce some power, although it was not enough power to do a typical landing. There were multiple ways to land the Harrier, but it wasn't producing much power. Again, fortunately, and certainly the training kicks in there, situational awareness, workload management, following checklists, handling the aircraft, everything that I'd learnt so far in my military fast jet training came to bear, and I was able to recover the aircraft to RAF Wittering. The jet engine in the Harrier, the Pegasus engine that on the aircraft I was flying, had actually one of the compressor blades. For those of you that know about jet engines, had sheared off near the hub and gone through the rest of the engine. And in fact, several of the compressor stages blades were then missing from the damage of the first blade coming off. Rolls-Royce were amazed that the engine had restarted and indeed produced any power. And I was, of course, very grateful to recover the aircraft. Fast forward another 3 months, I'm almost at the end of my flying training. And none of you will want to fly a Sea Harrier, even if you could after this conversation. But I was completing one of my very last flights, two of us intercepting another two Sea Harrier aircraft for practice. We completed that intercept, and I was then turning away to catch up with my wingman and complete another one when there was another huge explosion. I couldn't breathe, I couldn't see momentarily, and again, I had to think what has happened here. And what had happened was the canopy above my head had shattered. It transpired a fatigue issue had led to this to happen, and the canopy shattered into lots of pieces, some pieces of which went down the engine. So the engine momentarily surged, and I was at 30,000 feet at around about 0.9 Mach, so not too far off the speed of sound, flying a Cabriolet Sea Harrier. It took me a while to gather my thoughts, to lower my seat so that I was out of the wind as much. And fortunately, I was successful in, with the help of my wingman, recovering the aircraft to RAF St. Athan at that time. But again, a hugely serious emergency. And all of these three events had happened in the space of 1 year. What I will then say happened was that I perhaps wasn't dealing with this as well as I could have done, and nor were some of my colleagues in terms of supporting me. I will admit to perhaps not acting in the way that I was becoming of a Royal Naval officer at that stage in terms of how I spoke to one or two of my instructors, but quite clear to me now that what I was suffering with was most probably post-traumatic stress disorder. At that stage, the support, the knowledge, the awareness, I guess, of anything to do with mental health, this was back in 2003, was not what it is now. And without a doubt, that's likely what I was suffering with. So I completed my training and joined the front line. And I was on the front line when I had to, along the way, I'd had one spinal operation, believe it or not, and then I had to have another spinal operation. Unfortunately, this led to me being in so much discomfort, pulling G and sitting in that type of aircraft and doing that type of flying, that ultimately it meant the end of my time flying fast jets whilst I was with 801 Naval Fighter Squadron. And that was another challenge. Here I was now having had to stop that type of flying and face now the reality of everything I'd achieved coming to an end and having to leave and restart a new life, and not even aware if I was going to be able to do that and continue flying, which was my passion. But luckily, moving away from the fast jet flying gave my back time to heal, gave me time to get the treatment that it needed. And I was lucky enough to move into a career in commercial aviation. I'd like to talk more about briefly the servicemen and women that leave the forces. There are some fantastic charities out there now doing some work to support servicemen and women that leave with service injuries, some of which, of course, are far, far worse than the injury I suffered. But more could be done. And so if there's anyone out here listening and would like to talk to me about this subject, I'd be delighted, of course, to talk to you more and learn more about it and see what we can do to raise awareness of service people leaving the services. It's something that I think the US do very, very well with their service people. I think we could do a lot more in the UK. However, I moved to the airline world. What a different world. Not only was I now not bound to military isms, the law, if you like, or having to spend my life in military type environments, I was now living a new life, flying for an airline out of Manchester, which ultimately became my home for, having been a student in that area, but then became my home for about 13 years. A fantastic city, one of my favourite cities in the world, if not the favourite. And I was now flying airlines, very, very different type of flying, incredibly different, but I absolutely loved it. It was really, really nice to be able to operate in a multi-crew environment, to work with lots of different people. So the cabin crew team, really diverse community, fantastic people, the airline I worked for then and now, of course. And there were some key differences, though. I would say that military banter is somewhat unique, and I had to quickly adapt before I upset somebody. But my career in commercial aviation now has outlived my career as a military pilot by quite some time. And in fact, I'm almost 15 years of commercial flying now. And it's taught me so many amazing skills, from threat and error management, managing risk. And of course, that doesn't just extend to my time at work. It's something that I see threats and errors in daily life, and that has genuinely had a real positive impact on other areas of my life. The airline industry does this incredibly well. It's learnt, sadly, on the back of it not doing it very well in years gone by, and lots of our training and techniques and ways of operating have now, in fact, been adopted by the medical profession for the same reasons. So lots of crossover between that. And again, I'd be really interested to talk to people about that crossover between aviation and the medical world. There are several frustrations for me, though, working in the airline world. I now work for a really big airline, and I'm lucky enough to be flying a fantastic aircraft, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. I have genuinely visited places that would be on people's bucket list to visit just once in their life, and I've done it many times. I feel incredibly privileged to be able to visit those places, to work for an esteemed company, without mentioning who they are, and to work with some fantastic colleagues from across the organisation. but there are still some frustrations for me as a pilot. One of those frustrations was the minority pilot groups. I was looking through my logbook recently just to check I'd got my facts straight. And in 15 years of airline flying, I've flown with less than 10 female pilots. Of course, it's not just female pilots, so people from different ethnic backgrounds, lots of other minority pilot groups. And I don't know what the reasons are for this, and it's something that I'm going to be investigating more fully. Clearly, it's not just one reason. I have my own theories on it, and it's something I'm going to be talking about more at a later date. But if we just look initially at female pilots, only 5% approximately of the world's pilots are female pilots. That's an extremely low level. In my mind, that's unacceptable low level. There are some initiatives to try and encourage more women into aviation, which is fantastic, but it's still an unacceptable level. And I think it's up to all of us to inspire everybody from the youngest age possible to say, you can do this. And being a pilot is certainly one of those jobs which everybody should be encouraged to do. It's a fantastic career, and it's a career that anyone with the passion, the drive and the determination can achieve. But I'm going to return to this topic in more detail soon. But certainly, if anyone is out there and thinking they aren't capable of it, or they're lacking the support and they need some inspiration, please do get in touch, because I'm passionate about that area of my job, being lucky enough to do what I do. Other things that flying has taught me outside of the cockpit, being an airline pilot, certainly being a long haul airline pilot, is quite a rigorous working schedule. Now, a lot of people will joke at airline pilots because they only see us going to work on the odd day, particularly as a long haul pilot. But an awful lot of our life is spent flying at strange times, and that leads to extreme fatigue. And when you may only get one or two days at home before having to go away again, having maybe flown somewhere west of the UK for with an 8-hour time zone change, and then 2 days later going east to an 8-hour time change in the other direction, and having only had 2 days at home to see friends, see a partner, catch up on jobs around the house, and indeed try and rest. It's very, very difficult. And fatigue management is something that is a challenge for airlines, and certainly a challenge for crews, not just pilots, of course, but cabin crew team as well. And it is hard. But that fatigue and managing those relationships, it's helped me essentially manage those relationships. Again, I don't always act or react in the right way when I'm particularly tired, but I try. If I don't, then I'll accept the critique. And these are things that I've learnt. It's also helped me as a child. I was a particularly shy child, probably down to the bullying aspects I suffered at school. But being a commercial pilot has helped me grow in confidence, meeting new people pretty much every time I go to work, meeting customers. And you meet people from all over the world, and I'm fascinated by it. But all of those aspects really combined in commercial aviation have helped me massively outside of the cockpit. I'm, of course, a passionate pilot, and being an airline pilot doesn't enable you necessarily to indulge in the passion of real free flight, because everything we do is bound by rule, regulation, and, of course, most importantly, safety. And around about 8 years ago, I was really missing just, for pilots, they'll know this phrase, poling an aeroplane around. So holding onto the joystick and just flying around. And one of my friends at my previous airline asked me if I'd like to go and try out gliding one day. So off we went to a gliding club called Boland Forest up in the Lake District area. And it was winter, it was cold, but there was a hill nearby and the wind was blowing. And I didn't realise at this stage what that meant. Off we went and launched in this glider on a winch, which is a cable, essentially like a fishing reel that reels you in. Up we went into the sky and flew straight towards this hill. And the air rushing up the hill created what they call, I now know, ridge lift. And we stayed airborne for an hour. And I was genuinely astounded that we could do this. Most gliding involves flying in what they call thermals. And if you've ever watched a buzzard or another bird of prey, or even seagulls, circling in the air, that's exactly what they're doing. They're using invisible bubbles of air called thermals to climb without having to expend any energy flapping their wings. And that's what we do in gliding. And it enables us to fly huge distances with no form of propulsion. And in fact, I've flown over 540 kilometres in the UK without any need for propulsion, and it still astounds me every day. It's given me my real passion for aviation back. But on top of that, it's just a fantastic sport of lots of like-minded people, and a great place for young people to get involved in aviation. There's a great community of young people known as UK Junior Gliding that I support through our business. But those guys and girls get to learn about teamwork, safety, risk management, meteorology, reading the weather, and they get to do it all together and have fun doing it. So I'm a huge supporter of gliding as a way to get into aviation. So go and check out the British Gliding Association if you'd like to. Go and give it a go. Certainly it's led to some other highlights of my flying life, from flying in Australia to the French Alps, and even in South Africa, flying with birds of prey up at 15,000 feet. It is truly an amazing sport, and I feel, again, incredibly privileged to be able to partake in it. Well, all of this sort of career and everything I've learned from my school life and my officer training, my military career, my airline career, clearly I'm somebody who likes a challenge, and I like to find something new to do. And I also, building on my experiences in life, really enjoy helping people. I've always enjoyed it, but particularly in the last few years. And because I left the armed forces slightly earlier than I was predicted to, a few years later, several of my former colleagues were leaving the armed forces. And it's very common, of course, for military pilots to move into the world of commercial aviation. And they sought out my guidance to ask them how they could best prepare for their upcoming assessments to become a commercial pilot. And I started helping them with everything from completing their CV to a bit of interview preparation and other assessment processes that airlines put their candidates, their prospective captains of the future through. And it turned out that I was rather good at it. And I was encouraged by one or two people to consider making a business out of it. And you may have noticed, if you read the small biography of this podcast, or indeed if you're viewing it on our website, that I'm also the owner of my business, Flight Deck Wingman. And we now assist pilots from all backgrounds and experience levels, from aspiring pilots entering the industry, maybe going for a flight school assessment, to current airline pilots moving job, or maybe through redundancy being forced to move job, tragically, and of course military pilots moving into the world of commercial aviation. And again, my company is extremely successful at doing that, in no small part to the passion that we have for helping people. On a personal note, my passion for helping them, inspiring them, genuinely getting the best out of people, offering direct feedback and critique where it's going to help them, but of course doing so in a way that builds their confidence, enabling people to accept that feedback constructively, making sure that they set the highest standards and work hard. Essentially, I guess I'm saying bringing all of my experience and experiences in life to bear. And it's a really successful company. Lots more to come from it. Please do go and check it out. If you haven't, just follow the website link, www.flightdeckwingman.com, or check us out on social media. But anyway, that's the biggest plug I'm going to give that. Where are we going with these podcasts from now? Well, I've linked to lots of subjects within this opening podcast, and I want to come back to many of those subjects. We already have some really, really exciting guests lined up to speak to us, all in aviation-themed areas, but absolutely not just about aircraft and not just about being a pilot. So this podcast really is a podcast for everybody, where we hope that it will be a source of inspiration, perhaps just some easy listening, perhaps a chance to listen to some exciting stories even, and learn and share information and help and support for people. So please do keep an eye out for new podcasts coming very soon. In the meantime, thank you very, very much for listening. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak on my very first podcast for Flying Out Loud. And we're really looking forward to speaking to lots of exciting people and seeing where this goes over the coming months and indeed years. So for now, to everybody out there, thank you so much for listening. Take care of each other, look after each other, have fun flying if you are a pilot, and we'll be in touch and speak again very soon.